From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump continues today to defend his Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh as the allegations against him pile up. Kavanaugh and his first accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, are set to testify in Washington tomorrow. Here's President Trump this morning.
He's a gem. He's an absolute gem. And he's been treated very unfairly by the Democrats, who are playing a con game. They know what they're doing. It's a con. They go into a back room and they talk with each other, and they laugh at what they're getting away with. It's a con game.
But shortly after that came reports that the Senate Judiciary Committee is reviewing the allegations of a third woman, Julie Swetnick, represented by the high-profile attorney Michael Avenatti, who claims she was present at high school parties with Kavanaugh and saw him and his friend Mark Judge spike punches. She also says they were present, though not involved, when she was drugged and assaulted. It threw another day in a tumult. Let's bring in our political strategist. This week we have Matt Mikowiak, a Republican strategist. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
And Bill Press, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Bill.
Hello, hello.
Matt, got to start with you. Today, Kavanaugh said in a statement, "This is ridiculous from the Twilight Zone," about this third allegation. But his fellow Yale students are on the front page of the New York Times today, angry about his portrait of himself as a choir boy, saying he was actually a very heavy drinker. The Democrat Chuck Schumer is saying, in light of the new third allegation, Republicans should call these hearings off, do an investigation. What would you advise Republicans do?
Well, I think the simple fact that Michael Avenatti's involved really raises questions about the credibility of the charge. And I think you're seeing that from Democrats who really haven't embraced his involvement in this particular accuser. Look, this is a shocking headline. It's a little hard to believe that a prep student would be involved in a gang rape ring at the age of 15. It's even harder to believe that that would then be something that would never be caught in six separate FBI background checks that Brett Kavanaugh passed. This is not the first time he's been considered for a sensitive position. He was associate general counsel in the White House. He was staff secretary, one of the most sensitive jobs in our government. He was obviously nominated to the D.C. Circuit, the second highest court in the land. He passed background checks at all of those stages. Look, I think we all want to know the facts. If this were accurate, it would clearly be disqualifying and he should withdraw. I have no reason to believe it's accurate, but we do have an accuser out there who now, I guess, has a signed affidavit. So that does obviously put her credibility on the line. But I think this hearing is going forward tomorrow unless the accuser from California doesn't show up. And I think that remains an open question.
Bill, how do you see this right now?
Well, first of all, I'm really struck by the contrast between what we saw yesterday in Pennsylvania with Bill Cosby and what we're seeing in the United States Senate. I think this is the Me Too movement at its best and its worst, if you will. We saw in Bill Cosby, it took a lot of time, but we see how far the Me Too movement has come and Bill Cosby marching off to prison. And I think we see in the way Senate Republicans are treating Christine Ford and Deborah Ramirez and now Julie Swetnick, this third woman, we see how far the Me Too movement still has to go. It clearly has not penetrated the halls of Congress. It's certainly not the Republican caucus. Now, I hear what Matt says about we want to know all the facts. I would just have to point out the way this is going, the Republicans are not allowing time to hear all the facts. The idea that they would hold this hearing tomorrow, schedule a vote in the committee on Friday, and then they're talking about now maybe a vote of the full Senate on Saturday. That's not a fair process. That's a ramrod railroading this thing through, which I think is a mistake for everybody, especially the Republican Party.
Well, you think it'll happen that fast, Matt?
Do I think the hearing will happen on Thursday?
Do you think that all this timeline is that they're going to actually do this? If this hearing happens tomorrow and, you know, the senators hear from the accuser and from Kavanaugh, that they will really vote that quickly and confirm him?
I think they have a plan right now that if the hearing goes well, they will hold a committee vote Friday morning. The Senate Majority Leader will file cloture and that the vote would be Sunday, Monday or Tuesday on the Senate floor. Now, again, that's if the hearing goes well from their perspective. Obviously, everyone wants to see what the credibility of the first accuser is and the credibility of Kavanaugh is when they're both under oath, when they're both on camera, when they're both being asked questions by a serious attorney. That said, I know that Bill's mentioned the question of the FBI. I know Bill also knows that former Senator Joe Biden in 1991 said specifically, quote, "The FBI explicitly does not, in this or any other case, reach a conclusion, period." Now, Bill raises the question of timing.
But they did. The FBI did. They did take time for the FBI to investigate Anita Hill's charges, and then it was up to the committee to decide where they go. But why not take the time for the FBI? It wouldn't take that long, take a day and a half, to talk to all three of these women and to Brett Kavanaugh under oath, under risk of perjury, and then report that to the committee. What's the rush?
And to be fair, you're exactly right. I think in the Clarence Thomas situation, it took 2 or 3 days for the FBI to reopen it. I think the challenge here is these are last-minute allegations that are coming out really merely hours before the hearing tomorrow. As Bill knows and as everyone knows now, Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, has known about the first accuser's allegation since July, and she did really almost nothing with it. She decided to basically let people know that she had forwarded something to the FBI less than a week before the committee was planning to vote. This is all about delaying action by the Senate Judiciary Committee and ultimately the Senate past the midterm elections because the Democrats want to give themselves a chance to take the Senate back and hold this Senate seat open. And that's not me saying that. That's the New York Times saying that.
Let me jump in, Matt, for 1 second, because I hear you joining other voices wondering why is this all happening so late. But if we can believe any of the statistics, and we've been hearing them across the board for several weeks now, one in three women have been assaulted. There are a lot of Americans who understand why this has taken so long, because it's a horrific thing to come forward. It's a horrific thing to be accused, but really horrific to come forward and relive these things. Aren't you worried that if the Republicans don't take the day or two to have an investigation, your candidate, Brett Kavanaugh, your Supreme Court justice, is forever going to have an asterisk?
Well, and I think that's part of actually the goal on the other side. But look, we're gonna be able to see the accuser and the nominee questioned under oath on camera, answering tough questions for hours with a domestic audience of millions of people. And I think that will be a game changer. One of them will be seen as more credible, and this story will change based on that. Certainly, I want facts. I want information. These second and third accusers have come forward because of the first accuser. The first accuser did not come forward until the very end because Senator Dianne Feinstein sat on this needlessly for 6 or 7 weeks.
Well,
keep in mind,
she
had a chance.
She sat on it because the accuser wasn't sure she wanted to come forward.
Yeah, but she sat – okay, she never raised it privately with him. She never raised it in closed session. She never raised it in open session. That's an honest question to ask her.
If I may, Senator Dianne Feinstein, rightly or wrongly, was respecting the wishes of the woman who wrote the letter. But I have to say, look, this idea – focus – I think the opposition wants to focus on anything but the substance of the accusations. Did she wait a long time before she came forward? Did this come forward at the last minute? Yes. But if you look at Harvey Weinstein, you look at Bill O'Reilly, you look at Bill Cosby, you look at Les Moonves, these are all incidents that happened years ago. There are good reasons why these women did not come forward. Again, I think the challenge here is to examine the authenticity of the story of all three of these women, not just one of them. And by the way, why won't they call Mark Judge? He reportedly was the only other person in that room, and yet they're letting him totally off the hook. So I think this comes across in every respect, Matt, as just a rush job. And you say the Democrats are trying to delay it till after the midterms. I don't know about that, but I know the Republicans are trying to ram it through before the midterms because they're afraid they're going to lose.
Well, and I would just point out, I mean, you're comparing this to Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby was charged with a crime. Brett Kavanaugh's never been charged with a crime.
Right.
He was convicted by a jury of his peers. The evidence was overwhelming. You were talking, I think, about 60 different accusers. In this case, you're talking about now three accusers. And yes, that's concerning, but it's also very, very, very late. And we have not had anyone really fully under oath. And that'll start tomorrow. And I think all of America wants to see what the answers are.
Just in the couple minutes that we have left here, we are just weeks away from the midterm elections. All of this is happening right now as voters are starting to really think about what they're going to do. What's at stake, Matt, first to you about when it comes to the midterms with all of what's going on with Kavanaugh?
Well, what's at stake, obviously, is control of the House, control of the Senate. Democrats need to take 23 seats back to take control of the House. They need to take a net of two back to take control of the Senate. I think Democrats believe not just the House, but that the Senate could potentially be in play. In the Senate, they basically have to go 12 for 12, defend 10 seats with Democratic incumbents from states that Trump won, and then pick up likely Arizona and Nevada, although it looks like maybe Texas and Tennessee are in that mix. I think more narrowly, it's about suburban white women. That's what this is about, because suburban white women are going to have a disproportionately direct impact on the midterm elections. And so there's a political benefit, I think, to some extent to what the Democrats are trying to achieve here.
We got about a minute left. We haven't even mentioned that, the president was at the UN. There's an ongoing Russia investigation. Bill, just in the minute we have, just what do you think we're overlooking?
Well, what do we have?
Everything.
First of all, there's not time to talk about all the things that are going on. I just have to say to Matt's point, I think there's something else at stake in these midterm elections, is the dignity and the respect of the United States Supreme Court, which I think would be lost if they rush this through. Not so much if it gets on the court, but if they rush it through this way. And also, Matt mentioned suburban Republican women. Absolutely, they're going to be the key. And if I know that they're the key to the midterm elections, I would want to take a much more careful approach to what we're hearing from these three women, rather than, again, ram it through.
That's going to have to be it. Bill Press, our Democratic strategist this week, Matt Mikowiak, the Republican strategist. Boy, thank you both. Another week. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
President Trump chaired a meeting of the UN Security Council this morning as the UN General Assembly meets in New York, bringing in leaders from around the world. It's the 73rd time nations have gathered together in this forum. And for a look back at the history of the UN, we're joined by Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Good to be here.
So the UN came out of what's called the League of Nations, which was Woodrow Wilson's brainchild after World War I. But take it from there, Brian. What was his vision?
Well, Wilson felt that out of this tragedy of World War I could come a set of agreements and even an organization that might really end wars like that forever. He wanted to create a kind of international stability, not based on who had the biggest army, but basically on collective security agreements that countries would protect each other against aggression from outsiders. He also wanted that world order, if you will, to be a liberal world order. He wanted only nations that would be democracies where people had a voice in their own government. Now, there's a very important footnote there. People were defined primarily as white people, actually largely white men in many of these countries. So those what might be referred to later as third world countries, countries like Vietnam, for instance, countries that had colonial relationships with European nation states, were seen as second bit or third bit players in this world order. And the last principle was that it should be capitalist. I mean, remember, the Soviet Union, the Russian Revolution, out of World War I comes a communist nation in Russia. And it was very important to Wilson that this world order be one that was established based on trade between capitalist countries.
And what did the League of Nations get done?
Not much, because a very important player was not part of that league, namely the United States of America.
Right.
One of the great ironies of history is that vision that was very much promoted by Woodrow Wilson was absolutely stymied by his own Congress, the American Congress. Now, you've heard of the midterms, right, Jeremy?
Yeah, they're coming right up.
Well, there was something called the midterms, and Republicans took over the House and the Senate. And there was this mechanism for collective security that came out of Article 10. And that mandated that every country in this league would come to the aid of another country that was attacked. And many Americans, especially Republicans, especially Henry Cabot Lodge, felt that, you know, this was going to drag America into wars that America did not need to get involved in.
The seeds of what become the United Nations come out of this 1930s period, once you realize how hard it is to prevent interventions. And also Roosevelt himself adopts what was called good neighbor policy and begins to initiate a different kind of diplomacy built largely on commerce with, you know, brother countries in the Americas. And this idea of a kind of good neighbor approach would become really important to what ultimately became the foundational charter of the United Nations in the 1940s.
And let's listen to Harry Truman, the president who signed the official charter in 1945 in San Francisco.
The Charter of the United Nations, which you are now signing,
is a solid structure upon which we can build for a better world. History will honor you for it. Between the victory in Europe and the final victory in Japan, in this most destructive of all wars, you have won a victory against war itself.
So was it in 1945 when that charter was signed, basically the UN that we have today?
I would say in its basic form, it is the same United Nations. And its purpose was, to just pick up on what Nathan said, to promote trade, to provide a modicum of collective security, but also to begin establishing institutions that would help connect nation states together across borders, across boundaries, because, of course, trade had grown across those borders. And the through line between Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt and Truman, all Democrats, was free trade. And it's very important to remind our listeners that the whole system was set up to advantage the United States, and it worked out to advantage the United States.
Nathan, today the UN is associated with all kinds of things that don't have to do with what exactly is going on in that building in Manhattan. We've got the, you know, refugee programs,
right.
UNESCO. I was in Luang Prabang in Laos earlier this year, and that is the whole city is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So, you know, you can't change a lot of the things about the city. It's a beautiful historic city. But tell us about some of the things the UN has done all these years.
Yeah, so in addition to, you know, UN health programs, and you mentioned refugee programs, I mean, the importance of UNESCO can't really be overstated. I mean, you're talking about an effort to bring the world together on the axes of science and education and culture, and to use, you know, a sense of global culture to animate an idea about world peace. I mean, again, the World Heritage Sites also attest there's a sense that the world's great cultures and great contributions belong to us all. So there are nearly 1,100 of these World Heritage Sites around the world, and they help to stave off redevelopment or the erasure of really important sites of world culture, including, say, slave forts on the west coast of Africa or other important landmarks around the world. So I think, you know, understanding that there are sinews that are binding together the world's peoples that will hopefully be the starting point for other kinds of efforts at peace, that becomes a really critical contribution that the UN can take credit for.
When I think of the United Nations, one of the names that comes to mind is Kofi Annan, who just died last month, but was the Secretary General of the United Nations, was known as a big interventionist, but also was against the Iraq War. Let's take a listen to a little bit of Kofi Annan.
Perhaps if we had persevered a little longer, Iraq could yet have been disarmed peacefully, or if not, the world could have taken action to solve this problem by a collective decision.
Nathan, was he one of the giants of the UN over all these many decades?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, Kofi Annan's tenure, which was, you know, nearly a decade from the late 90s to the early 2000s, was an effort to balance two of the most important purposes that the UN served. One was to protect notions of state sovereignty, and the other was to intervene on questions of human rights. I mean, echoing Brian's earlier point, you can't overlook the fact that the UN was very important for arguments about self-determination among peoples around the world. But at the very same time, when you have moments of cultural genocide or moments of ethnic cleansing, it was important by Annan's own estimation to have the UN be in a position to intervene and protect human rights. And so it's extraordinarily important to recognize that this attempt to balance kind of two visions of sovereignty, one about self-determination, but one about global responsibility, becomes a hallmark of his era. He wins the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001 for helping to revitalize the UN and try to give it credibility. And again, I think the way in which he helped to shape the organization has still become a very important measuring stick for the way that we decide now as an international community whether or not to intervene in places like, say, Libya or in Syria or elsewhere around the world.
I want to ask about one more thing, and I want to hear one more piece of tape. And this is from John Bolton, who is now President Trump's national security advisor. But in the past, he has had a lot of hostility toward the UN. Listen.
The Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference.
If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. Brian, has that kind of criticism always existed for the UN?
I don't think it's existed at such a high level. But yes, it has always existed. It really emerged publicly, again, not at such a high level, in the very late 1950s, in the guise of the John Birch Society, conservative, reactionary organization that was very concerned about communism. And some of their fears were that the United Nations was, the front lines for world government, and that this organization was going to come in and strip Americans of their liberties. Over the years, others, conservatives, have criticized the United Nations for being wasteful in its spending, and then later for advocating for countries, often countries in Africa or in Latin America, that did not agree with the United States. And they argued, boy, why should we be supporting an organization where people actually don't agree with us? Of course, the entire vision of the United Nations was to provide a forum, a venue to work out these differences through debate, discussion, and the kinds of programs that Nathan was referring to, rather than through aggression and war. It strikes me personally as a pretty good idea.
I wonder if each of you can remember an example before last year when the words Rocket Man were uttered in the United Nations.
I cannot, actually.
All right. That's one.
You got me there, Jeremy.
Okay, good. Two historians say it's never happened before. Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you,
Jeremy.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
People of color are vastly underrepresented in children's literature. The situation is slowly changing, but not authentically enough for some. Lisa Phillip of member station WUNC reports on what some moms and educators in North Carolina are doing about it.
Let's read from Brotherly Love.
Years ago, librarian Judy Allen Dodson was reading to her kids.
And my son said, "Mommy, how come I don't see any children that look like me in there?" And I said, "You know what? I'm going to write you that story."
A decade ago, the Raleigh, North Carolina mom began work on a kid's chapter book. She just submitted Micah's Magic to publishers. It's about a black boy who time travels with his friends to 1930s Chicago, where they meet the first all-black professional basketball team.
My children are avid readers, but they don't see themselves. And that works on your psyche, your spirit.
A quarter of children's books published last year feature non-white characters. That's according to a report from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Only half of American kids are white.
For all children, whether that be children of color, whether that be children that may have a disability, they just want to feel normal and see themselves.
Next month, Dodson is co-hosting a symposium for children's authors and illustrators of color. They'll discuss why diversity matters, not just in characters, but among creators, too. Kelly Starling Lyons is one of those creators. She's a Raleigh-based children's writer and co-host of the symposium.
So you'll see more books that have a brown face in a crowd or even, you know, a brown child on the cover. But then when you look and you see who wrote the book or is there any cultural authenticity to the story, then sometimes that's lacking.
Minority authors penned 15% of children's literature published last year. That's according to the UW-Madison report. Paletta Brown Bracey is a scholar of children's literature at NC Central University.
People of color are writing, but people of color are not getting published as much as they should be getting published.
She says minority authors hit stumbling blocks in the publishing industry, a business in which 4 out of 5 employees are white. Nearly 9 out of 10 executives are white.
That poses a conflict sometimes for people of color who are working with white editors who don't have the same level of appreciation for the culture.
Bracey says change needs to come from the industry side. Lyon says it has to come from the parent side, too.
Judy and I are moms first. If we want to have those books for our kids, we can't just leave it to the publishers. Or we have to also be advocates and activists. And it doesn't have to be holding a picket sign per se. It can be little things. Your dollar speaks really loudly.
If I can find it, I will show you.
7-year-old Amia Bird is searching the children's section at a Southeast Raleigh Public Library branch. She's looking for one book in particular she likes.
When's my birthday? Because it
Amia's mom, Kia, says she's made a point of buying kids books that represent their family's culture and the Black experience.
Because she's going to get a lot of everything else outside of home, so we wanted her to know that there are people that look like her and that have had similar experiences to her that are doing extraordinary things.
Amia certainly appreciates it.
It's important for us to have books that tell us, hey, it's okay to be who you are. You can stand out. You can do what you want to do.
And maybe even become a published children's book author one day. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Philip.
A third woman is accusing Brett Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct in high school on the eve of his scheduled appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee and just 2 days before senators are scheduled to vote on whether to advance his nomination to the Supreme Court. Let's take a look now at how media coverage of this story is shaping the narrative around President Trump's embattled nominee.
I want to bring in David Fogenflik, NPR's media correspondent and co-host of On Point. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin, Jeremy.
So, you know, as the day unfolds, it's another day of the media seeming to scramble, let's face it, to catch up with another breaking news story. Just your thoughts on the news as it's been breaking today.
Well, the news of this latest accuser by name in a statement from a woman who apparently has had a career with multiple security clearances with the federal government, acknowledging that she's making this declaration on pain of perjury basically Judge Kavanaugh being present as a high schooler at essentially she accuses him of being witness to some pretty astonishing sexual assaults.
Right.
NPR and a number of other major news organizations have been pretty careful and tentative, I would say, in the hours immediately following the posting of her statement by Michael Avenatti in getting into the specifics, as NPR and others have not been able to for themselves verify not only the allegations that she's made, but haven't been able to sort of question her. You know, this as one of the reporters for the New York Times, who has been a leading figure on a lot of the Me Too coverage, put it on Twitter today. This is something that has been brought forward by an attorney without any vetting from reporters. That doesn't negate in any way her declaration, but it does mean that journalists haven't had a chance to, shall we say, question or probe and understand a little bit about the implications of all that she said.
Okay, so a complicated story to cover. There's another one that I want to ask you about that happened this week as well, which involves the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. There were reports earlier this week that suggested he could soon be departing the administration. The news site Axios set off a flurry of speculation on Monday morning after its national political reporter Jonathan Swan reported that Rosenstein had resigned. Then Washington media went scrambling to confirm the news. They were staking out the White House driveway where Rosenstein was supposed to arrive. But by the afternoon, he still had a job. And the White House spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, said Trump would meet with him on Thursday. That's tomorrow, when the president returns from the UN General Assembly. David, Axios started this. Now, they did update their story and said Rosenstein had only offered to resign. But what happened? How did this all unfold?
You know, you saw the Deputy Attorney General apparently going to the White House for, among other things, a meeting at which he was supposed to attend in place of the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was traveling, I believe, to give a talk about the opioid abuse and crisis. And it appears as though Rosenstein was prepared to perhaps tender his resignation. It may have been discussed after, of course, coverage in preceding days about his deep reservations about the president, after the firing of then FBI Director James Comey in the spring of 2017. And we can talk about that story in a moment. But what Axios did was essentially make it sound like a fait accompli, and it made it sound as though it was happening and had happened. I think it was a mess. You were seeing events unfold and people were talking and reporting on them as though though somehow they had already come to a stop and things were in motion. You know, it's my sense that actually a lot of the players in this drama weren't entirely clear on how it was going to play out. So the idea that you're saying this with clarity, you know, is almost necessitated, I think, by the mediums in which this information is provided. That is that the reporters are doing things because they can post things online. They can push them out on Twitter. People can go on cable and talk about them instantaneously. And I think that's driving people's perceived need to do this ahead of what they were able to pin down. I do think it was not only irresponsible, but bewildering for most normal citizens if they encountered these constantly shifting accounts of what was about to happen or what indeed was said to have already happened.
Right. But it's a tough thing, David. I mean, if a source has heard from Rosenstein directly, as we were told, that he was going to the White House and he presumed to be fired, well, then you've got a big story, you know, and
also it wouldn't be that surprising if that were the case, because President Trump has fired people, you know, even on Twitter. That wouldn't be so surprising.
But I mean, look, understand also this is one of those stories where if it's going to happen, it will actually happen.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you can couch and say carefully, you can say, look, the very nature of his job seems to be in doubt. He may be hanging by a thread. There are signs that he's considering resigning. But if you don't have confidence in the clarity of your reporting, and let's remember, the Justice Department and the White House are not on the same page at the moment. Yeah. So you have various kinds, and for that matter, the White House itself has various factions within it. So you have sources who may have different imperatives, who may have different spins, who may have different desired outcomes, who may be trying to force cards in a way that you don't have a unified administration saying this is what's happening.
Yeah. I gotta ask
and
you,
I think that makes it all the more complicated.
I want to ask you one last thing, David. President Trump, of course, at the UN this week. Yesterday, he addressed the General Assembly, and we all have heard this moment where usually these speeches are about global interest, and it became sort of a campaign speech from him touting his administration. Let's listen.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Laughter. And at other times during the speech, the cameras cut away to, let's say, the German representatives laughing at him when he was talking about them. All the cable networks immediately, I would say CNN, MSNBC, immediately had montages, David, of President Trump talking about how the world was laughing at the U.S. The world was laughing at the U.S. under President Obama. That wasn't going to happen anymore. And here, of course, the UN was laughing at him. Cautionary tale about your words following you?
Well, I'm sure the president would like to think that people were laughing near him rather than at him, but that wasn't the case this time around. What was striking in some ways was if you looked at on social media in particular to its, I believe, 18 million followers, Fox News put out tweets in which the laughter was clipped out. And it stopped. And, you know, it's a tell if you come from a point of view that's sympathetic to the president's one thing. But, you know, if you're not able to show the full context, you're not doing your job.
That's David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. Thank you.
You bet.
And we want to take a moment to remember an historic milestone. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, and a battle that helped to bring that conflict to a close started on this day, September 26, 1918. More than 20,000 Americans would die in the Meuse-Argonne offensive in France. Patrick O'Donnell is a combat historian who studied the battle.
We had to go up against defenses that rivaled, you know, picture Omaha Beach, but many, many times over. Bunkered positions, trenches, barbed wire, you know, machine gun nests every few yards, snipers. And somehow they had to break through this without any body armor, just steel helmets. And, you know, in most cases, bolt-action rifles and some grenades.
There were many heroes at Meuse-Argonne. One of them was Samuel Woodfill, a soldier from Bryansburg, Indiana.
They're taking, you know, massive casualties, and they're being hit by snipers and machine gun nests. Woodfill takes out a man, a machine gun nest, you know, many hundreds of yards away with his rifle, keeps pushing forward. They're hit by gas. I mean, this is something that most Americans have no concept of. The gas was just, mustard gas was horrendous. It was these oily droplets that just stuck to the body and caused massive irritation. And he's being hit by that. He's not able to get his mask on. And he's fighting hand-to-hand as he's pushing forward. Takes out several more machine gun nests. He uses his .45 caliber pistol to dispatch a German, runs out of ammunition, and the only thing that is available is a pickaxe. And he literally uses the pickaxe against a German soldier to stay alive and to basically keep pushing forward. And he's able to do that and regroup with his men.
Combat historian Patrick O'Donnell talking about Samuel Woodfill's actions during the Battle of Meuse Argonne. Samuel Woodfill later received the Medal of Honor. American and French forces defeated the Germans after weeks of fighting. That defeat led to the German surrender and the end of the First World War on November 11th, 1918. Christine Blasey Ford is scheduled to testify tomorrow before the Senate Judiciary Committee about her allegations that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her at a party when they were both teens. There have been additional allegations of sexual misconduct from two other women, including one whose statement was released in just the last few hours, as we've been reporting. Judge Kavanaugh has vehemently denied the allegations, saying they're part of a smear campaign against him. The accusations, though, have sparked heated debates about whether such behavior is normal for a teen and whether an adult should be held responsible for what some view as youthful mistakes. NPR's Lynn Neary looked into those questions.
Everybody knows that teenagers can be wild, that they're often eager to experiment with alcohol, drugs, and sex. Those assumptions about teens have been backed up by research. Lawrence Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University who specializes in adolescents.
One way that we like to think about it metaphorically is that the adolescent brain is going through a period of time when the accelerator is pressed to the floor, but there's not a good braking system in place.
Steinberg says research shows that the brain is still developing into the early to mid-20s. Parts of the brain that govern self-control and self-regulation are still maturing.
17-year-olds are more impulsive, they're more vulnerable to peer pressure, and they're more likely to misbehave. If you look at crime statistics, what you see is that both violent and nonviolent crime peak in the late teen years. So it is a time when people take a lot of risks and do a lot of things that they won't do later.
Steinberg says U.S. courts, including the Supreme Court, have taken this into account in rulings on juvenile justice. Young people are held accountable for their crimes, but their age, the courts have said, can be considered when it comes to sentencing. And while some have dismissed the allegation against Judge Kavanaugh as normal for a teenage boy, Josh Rovner of the Sentencing Project says the behavior that Ford described is not a harmless aberration.
Attempted rape is a very serious offense. This is not something that one would simply overlook.
The party where the encounter between Ford and Kavanaugh was alleged to have occurred was in Maryland. Rovner says a juvenile accused of attempted rape in Maryland could be tried as an adult. But Ford never reported an attack. There was no criminal charge. And if it had gotten into the system, Rovner says, Kavanaugh might very well have gotten off lightly.
We do know that when cases do go to authorities, that we see prosecutors handling young people differently based on their background. And so someone growing up in a wealthy community in Bethesda who was going to a good school is probably going to get a different treatment in the juvenile and adult system than a child of lesser means living in Baltimore.
But whether an allegation becomes a criminal charge or remains unreported, just how long should a youthful transgression, no matter how serious, hang over someone's head? Rabbi Shai Held says an act committed early in life must be dealt with eventually.
Jewish ethics, I think it's fair to say, assumes that a 17-year-old is not a fully formed adult, but is also decidedly not a child, right? A person is close enough to adulthood, is actually responsible for his or her own behavior at that age. That remains, as it were, on their record, on their kind of existential and spiritual record. It's something they have to make an accounting for.
Judge Kavanaugh would no doubt argue that he has nothing to account for because the assault he is accused of never happened. And that assertion, says retired Judge Nancy Gertner, must be examined. Before she was on the bench, Gertner was both a civil rights lawyer and a defense attorney. As a civil rights lawyer, she worked on behalf of women in sexual harassment and rape cases. And as an activist, she fought to reform rape laws. But as a criminal defense attorney, she saw things from a different perspective.
I understood the ways in which a false accusation can wreck someone's life. In that sense, what hung in the balance was jail.
As the mother of two boys, Gertner also worries that her own sons, like any young men, could be falsely accused. In the case of Judge Kavanaugh, Gertner says, it's possible something that happened when he was a teenager could have been explained.
If the answer here had been, wow, I did drink too much when I was in high school, and I don't remember this, but I'm terribly sorry if it happened. That kind of acknowledgement would be very different. First of all, to say never happened, you know, raises a different question, which is the judge telling the truth?
Back in the 1980s, when Judge Kavanaugh was a teenager, his denial might have been enough. But that's not the case now, says Gertner. The rules governing sexual relations are changing rapidly, and she believes both women and men stand to benefit from a full investigation of any charge of sexual harassment or assault.
I mean, when I grew up, the overwhelming rape law assumed that women always lied about sex, and the law embodied that shibboleth. You can't go from that to say women always tell the truth about sex. I mean, the issue has to be investigated. You have to engage with it. You have to understand it. You have to look at it. There has to be a hearing. You just can't flip from one to the other.
As things stand now, Gertner says, we may never know what really happened at that teenage party so many years ago. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And we will continue to follow this story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.